Hi, everyone, and welcome back for another edition of Radio Otherwhere. It feels like an age since we were together, but now that BBS Radio has moved to its new home in Paradise, you can expect the show this week and definitely every other week to bring you some of the best information I can find in the fields of consciousness studies, edge science, astronomy, holistic health, hidden archaeology and ancient mysteries, ufology, and more to stimulate, enlighten, and empower you. Knowledge is power, and so I'm really pleased to report that while we've been off the air, I've been getting busy lining up some of the most incredible guests for the coming weeks. They've all got amazing knowledge and amazing wisdom to share with us, starting tonight with this week's guest, William Henry. And if you're a first-time listener to the show, I hope that you stay with me for the next couple of hours. It's going to be a jam-packed program. We've been away for a few weeks, so we've got a lot of news to catch up on, and I've got a lot of news that I want to share. So let me tell you about some of the guests that we've got lined up for the following weeks. Next week on the show, we'll be joined by Dr. Francesca McCartney, a medical intuitive and founder of the Academy of Intuition Medicine. And in the first hour, we'll be learning all about the consciousness of water, speaking with Anna Webb in Hawaii, who's recently been trained as a Hado practitioner with Dr. Masaru Emoto, the doctor who wrote The Hidden Messages in Water. Carmen Warrington and David Jones will be appearing the week after that, discussing sacred sounds and making a very brief appearance. A Dutch artist, Janosch, will be talking to us about an upcoming tour of Australia where he'll be bringing us sacred geometry, information and messages from the Arcturians and decoded crop circles. The following week, Ananara Zolta joins us. She's an angelic transference healer. Now, I'm not going to tell you anything more about that. You're just going to have to wait for that show because I can promise you, you will have never ever heard anything like Ananara before. And in the month of April, we start off with near-death experiencer Mellon Thomas Benedict. I am so incredibly thrilled to be able to say that he'll be joining us as one of our guests. Jean Manning from the New Energy Movement will be coming up after that, and Janosch will be turning for a full-length interview, and right at the end of April, Michelle Eloff from South Africa to discuss the Ascended Masters and what it's like to be a trance channel. And so if you're not already sure, Otherwhere is anything that activates, enhances, or evolves the inner technologies of the multidimensional human. My name's Liz Miller, and it's my pleasure to be your host this week and every other week on Saturday nights here on BBS Radio. On this week's show, we find out about a new Russian patent for an invisibility cloak. Yes, it's finally happened. We'll go down to the South Pole to find out about a machine called Amanda. This little machine is capturing ghostly particles from space called neutrinos, and they could provide the first evidence for string theory. So I'm sure there are a lot of quantum physicists out there who are very, very excited about that. We'll also discover how nutrient synergy may be one key to preventing or healing cancer. We'll hear some of Ray Kurzweil's prediction of the future and what he calls the singularity from an interview that he did in Ubiquity magazine. To Italy, firstly underground to a brand new archaeological dig, and you'll be very excited, I think, for those people who love Egyptian artifacts out there to discover what's been found, and to the Italian skies. But more about that later. And we'll land back in the US to finish our world tour to unlock the secrets of the latest NASA mission to land, Project Stardust. And that project, along with the ancient stargates of the gods, connecting the dots between ancient myths, symbolism and sacred texts, and the exploration of Sumerian, Egyptian and Mayan civilizations will serve as the focus of our discussion with this week's guest and one of my favorite people, investigative mythologist and author, William Henry. But first, in a story from Interfax News, a professor from the Department of Quantum and Optical Electronics of the Ulyanovsk State University in Western Russia has invented a method of making things invisible. The so-called invisibility cloak, created by Oleg Gadomsky, is called the method of conversion of optical radiation in the patent. Gadomsky has long been experimenting on nanoparticles of gold. He now claims to have invented a submicron stratum of microscopical colloid golden particles that makes an object placed behind it invisible to an observer. He says, only static objects can be made invisible for the time being, as during motion the radiation frequency changes, but soon it will be possible to create a cap of darkness and a magic cloak like Harry Potter's. And now a story from physorg.com. Northeastern University and the University of California scientists say they might soon have evidence of extra dimensions and other exotic predictions. Early results from a neutrino detector South Pole called Amanda suggest ghost-like particles from space could serve as probes to a world beyond our familiar three dimensions. The evidence, they say, would come from how neutrinos interact with other forms of matter on Earth. No more than a dozen high-energy neutrinos have been detected so far. However, the current detection rate and energy range indicate Amanda's larger successor, which is called Ice Cube, now under construction, could provide the first evidence for string theory and other theories that attempt to build upon our current understanding of the universe. And speaking of space, from unknowncountry.com, here's a report from early February from Italian UFO investigator and reporter Paola Harris, who relayed news about a mass UFO sighting over the city of Milan. She says it was a Saturday night, the 4th of February, and there were five objects that lingered in the air from 11 p.m. till 5 a.m. Italian TV news channels covered it, but like the Phoenix lights in 1997, she says no one knew what to do. Apparently people were standing around in the street and, they'd been up there for so long, people actually got tired of photographing the objects. So quite an interesting sighting. The objects still remain at this time to be a pure unknown. But Paola also states that something is in the air that tells me something big is about to happen. And Communion author Whitley Strieber agrees that this is possible. He says that from the beginning, I've speculated that extended interaction might start with a series of protracted appearances like this one over major cities. If this is correct, then the phenomenon will spread to other large cities in the near future. Initially, witnesses assumed that the objects were stars, but they changed both colour and shape, causing observers to call police and the news media. If you'd like to see these objects, you can go and check out the links to this story and all the other news stories I cover on the show at my blogette at www.otherware.blogspot.com, or follow the links from the Otherware page at bbsradio.com. And staying in Italy, archaeologists have been digging for more than a year at the villa of Roman Emperor Hadrian in Tivoli have unearthed a monumental staircase, a statue of an athlete, and what appears to be a headless sphinx. The findings were presented a couple of weeks ago by government officials who described the discoveries as extremely important for understanding the layout of the ruins. The staircase is believed to be the original entrance to the villa, which was built for Hadrian in the 2nd century AD. So far, 15 steps, each 27 feet wide, have been identified, and archaeologists did not rule out uncovering more. Officials said that the newly uncovered area of the site, northeast of Rome, would be open to the public within a year. When we come, we've got some more news stories to take us up to our meeting with William Henry, which will be something that I'm sure many of you out there are looking forward to. And I've got to say, it was an absolute pleasure to speak with him, and I can't wait to play the interview later in the show. When William Henry joins us a bit later, we're going to get into some of the deeper aspects to the NASA mission Project Stardust. But for now, I thought I'd give you an update on how the scientists are going with the arduous task of retrieving samples of the interstellar dust and comet particles they collected during the mission's 2.88 billion mile round trip out into space. So far, they've been able to pick up the pace considerably in removing a number of particles from the aerogel, which is a low-density glass that they used to catch the tiny bits of comet and dust on. Dr. Peter Su tells us in the latest February 21 report that a Valentine's Day discovery was made that I thought I would share, as it's almost like a wave from the gods. He says, as part of the processing cycle, a particle was removed from the aerogel for further analysis on Valentine's Day, and to our surprise, we found the particle to be heart-shaped. Happy Valentine's to the world from Stardust. He goes on to say, I've been assured that this is the real shape of the particle, and you can actually go and check out the picture at the Project Stardust website, so please go and have a look. It looks great. And now here's some really fascinating thought processes from Ray Kurzweil. He's just been interviewed for Ubiquity magazine. He's one of the world's leading inventors, thinkers, and futurists. His latest book is the just published The Singularity is Near. And I was quite interested to read about his ideas of what he thinks the singularity is. So let's find out what he thinks the singularity is. Okay, he said, it's actually a complicated premise, but there are several key ideas. First of all, there's the idea that technology in general is accelerating rapidly, and information technology in particular is doubling its power, as measured in price, performance, and bandwidth capacity every year. We will see the power of information technology multiplied by a factor of a billion in 25 years. One of the things that he says in this interview is that one cubic inch of nanotube circuitry would be 100 million times more powerful than the human brain. So there's going to be plenty of capacity with three-dimensional molecular computing to keep these trends going for a long time. And he says that there are two key aspects to the concept of singularity, the hardware and software sides of emulating human intelligence. And this is where I was very fascinated. He says that soon we'll have sufficient hardware to recreate human intelligence, and we'll have it in a supercomputer by 2010. $1,000 of computation will equal the 10,000 trillion calculations per second that he estimates is necessary to emulate the human brain by 2020. The software side, he will take a little longer, in order to achieve the algorithms of human intelligence, sounding so much like Star Trek, don't you think, we need to actually reverse engineer the human brain and understand its principles of operation. And there again, not surprisingly, we see exponential growth, where we are doubling the spatial resolution of brain scanning every year, and doubling the information that we are gathering about the brain every year. We're showing that we can turn this data into working models and simulations, and there are also 24 regions of the brain that they've already modelled and simulated, including the cerebellum, which is where we do all of our skill formation and which compromises more than half the neurons in the brain. So, it's pretty amazing, don't you think? And where is it all going to lead? He says that this exponential progression will lead to an understanding of human intelligence. Well, I kind of thought we already did understand human intelligence, but he says by understanding he means that we will have detailed mathematical models and computer simulations of all the regions of the brain by the mid-2020s. So by the end of the 2020s, we'll be able to fully recreate human intelligence. Now, this is where it gets a little bit hairy. His second point is that non-biological intelligence, i.e. machinery, once it achieves human levels, will double in power every year, whereas human intelligence, biological intelligence, is fixed. Well, he says it's fixed. I don't know about that. He says we have 10 to the 26th power calculations per second in the human species today, and that's not going to change, but ultimately, the non-biological side of our civilization's intelligence will become, by the 2030s, thousands of times more powerful than human intelligence, and by the 2040s, billions of times more powerful. And that will be a really profound transformation. And now here's a great story for everybody out there who's interested in finding out some of the ways that we can eradicate cancer naturally. And it seems that some new research done by the laboratories of Matthias Rath Incorporated shows that healing cancer is more than possible through nutrient synergy. Now, what does that mean? That means by combining different nutrients to do the job together. Now, what they did was they took little vials and put a collagen matrix in the center of them, because apparently one of the ways that cancers metastasize is that they migrate through collagen membranes and into other parts of the body. So they took some of the vials and incubated cancer cells with nutritive agents, and in the upper chamber of other vials, they incubated cancer cells without nutritive agents. Afterwards, the researchers were able to determine which group of cancer cells was able to digest the collagen membrane and migrate to the lower chamber. The results of the experiment were remarkable. A simple combination of nutrients was able to stop the cancer cells from invading the collagen matrix. The most powerful nutrient combination contained vitamin C, the amino acids L-lysine and L-proline, and a polyphenol fraction of green tea known as EGCG, or epigallocatechin galate. And that's it for the news stories this week. Coming up after the break, we'll be speaking with this week's guest, William Henry, whose new book, The Illuminator, has just been released. And don't forget to get yourself warm and comfortable for the guided relaxation at the end of the show. We're going to get to all that deep-seated tension by aligning ourselves to the healing power of gratitude. So lots to look forward to, and once again, we can link up at the heart and form the Otherwhere Circle of Lights. It's with great pleasure that I welcome our next guest, William Henry, who's in Nashville, Tennessee. He's one of the leading investigative mythologists in the world and author of 12 books, including Cloak of the Illuminati, Blue Apples, Language of the Birds, and his latest, Oracle of the Illuminati, in which he states that we're on the verge of rediscovering the sacred science creating peace on Earth. He's an expert on connecting the dots between ancient myths, symbolism and sacred texts, including those of the Sumerian, Egyptian and Mayan civilizations, to the latest discoveries in science and consciousness, and in my opinion, uncovering some of the greatest secrets on Earth as he does so. William, it's an honour to have you join us today on Otherwhere and BBS Radio. Thank you for spending some time with us here.
My pleasure, Liz. Thanks so much for inviting me on the show.
Well, I couldn't help but ask you on because I've followed your career now for, I guess, the better part of 5 years, and observed how you've steadily gained a very loyal following all around the world. You've continued to be a prolific writer, not only writing books, but articles for your website as well. And you're appearing higher up on the bill at many conferences these days. You're still touring and lecturing with workshops, producing DVDs. You're so busy. And it's been a real adventure for me, you know, watching from afar to see how you've diligently persevered with your work, how you've stuck to your guns and
really thought deeply about the concepts that you bring to us, and it seems to be gaining wider and wider acceptance, you know, the things that you're talking about, the subject matter that you're delving into, and people seem to be really hungry for it. But it started somewhere when you were much younger, and that's where I'd like to start. Could you please tell us about where this all began for you? I guess it must have come at some stage when you decided, I need to know what the bigger picture is. Is that how it was?
Approximately, Liz, yeah. I grew up in Detroit, Michigan. I had moved to Nashville after I graduated from high school to go to college here in Nashville. I had planned to become an entertainment lawyer and work in the music business as an attorney in some capacity. And when I came here to Nashville, we have what's called Music Row. It's a world famous collection of record companies, labels, and this small Southern Baptist college offered a music business program that would prepare you to work on Music Row and then get into the entertainment industry. But the catch was that you had to take Bible study classes, because after all, it was a small Southern Baptist college. And growing up, I didn't have much by way of any kind of religious indoctrination. My family went to church. We were never really devoted to any particular church, or it wasn't a big part of our life. And it was while as a sophomore at this college that I was in a sociology class, and the professor assigned us to review a paper whose implications would impact Christianity. Well, this was September of 1982, and there was a brand new book on the shelf that year. It was called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And many listeners are probably familiar with that book. I read it the month that it came out, and it literally changed my life. I mean, it plugged me into this whole idea that there's this whole alternative story, and something in it just rang really, really big and resounding bells.
So that book captured your imagination. Do you think perhaps it's because since then you've discovered that you've actually got very deep connections to this work, that maybe there is a part of you that knows this information, that has always known this information, that you've brought that in with you into this life?
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. I don't have any anecdotal stories, or I don't have any real testimonial to that sort of interpretation, but it does sort of make sense to me personally that I just feel that things are one way, and it's not necessarily the way that it has been presented to us. And I continue to follow the muse, so to speak, that inspires me. And it's fortunately, as you said in your introduction, is starting to gain a lot of momentum. More and more people are coming this way in terms of viewing the alternative perspective from which I look at things, and also seeing primarily the interconnection of all things. Scholars tend to want to separate and divide, whereas those that follow more of an intuitive path seem to want to connect and to unite. And that's what one of the things that I find appeals to people, is that they enjoy so much the way that I can connect various cultures, various symbols and ideas into a seamless, not really a seamless, but more of a unified picture.
You like to put myth and scripture into the body. It's one of the ways that you connect the dots. And I think it's one of the most fascinating elements to your work. And one of the examples would be looking at lines in the Bible and viewing them through the lens of anatomy. Would you discuss that with the audience for a little while?
Yeah, that to me is what it's really all about. That's where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, because I believe that when we see the word temple in the Bible, or when we see a temple referred to maybe in a myth, that it's actually describing the functioning of the human body, because from the soul's perspective, the body is the temple. And once we begin to look at it from that perspective, all of a sudden we start getting all kinds of clues and hints and suggestions about the functioning of the body. One of my favorite examples is the story of Jacob's ladder. Briefly in the story, Jacob lays his head on a stone, has a dream in which he sees a ladder ascending and descending. He scales the ladder, note the musical term, goes to a higher finer realm, comes back down the ladder, takes a look around and says, you know, this place sucks. Well, that's not exactly what the Bible said. I mean, what Jacob said was, as terrible as this place, this is none other than the gate to God, and this is the gate to heaven. And by that, he either meant that this gate that he found himself at was a terrible place, or he realized that he had been to a higher, finer realm, and that earth isn't quite matching up to where he had just been. Or it indicates that what Jacob had experienced was an event or a place of tremendous power. And when you follow that story, Liz, it's so amazing because you have mainstream archaeologists that actually claim that they have found the actual stone that Jacob laid his head on. And it's supposed to be the stone upon which the kings and queens of Great Britain have been coronated for centuries. Well, I don't buy that story. I don't think that could be the actual stone that Jacob laid his head on. And so I was challenged to come up with an alternative version of the story or an alternative explanation for that example of myth or scripture. And I keep a book beside my desk at all times that's a key book for me. It's called Gray's Anatomy. And what I did in the story of Jacob's ladder is I went into the index and I looked up the word Jacob and found out that there's a part of our eye, a part of the retina of the human eye, which the retina acts as a light collector. And when you look into Gray's Anatomy, you find out that there are 10 layers to the retina of the eye. 9 of those layers are labeled with Latin medical terms. The 10th layer is called Jacob's layer.
That's quite astounding.
Yeah, and so with that, I began to wonder, is it possible that Jacob's ladder could be a reference to something going on in the eye? And as the story follows through, then we take a look at this idea of Jacob laying his head or brain on a stone. Well, one of the key elements that I use in terms of interpreting or deciphering myth and scripture is the rampant use of word plays or puns that were used by the ancients. And one of the key examples is that if you take the first letter S off the word stone, you're left with the word tone. And what that suggested to me is that, is it possible that when Jacob laid his head on a stone, that perhaps there was a vibration that altered his brain waves and caused his vision to expand in a way that he had never experienced before? And what that ultimately means to me is that anybody can have this experience. You don't have to go to any holy place or any particular dot of real estate or search out one particular stone. It's possible that the gate to God, the powerful place that Jacob experienced, is everywhere. It's wherever you are. And if we can find the way to tune our brain waves, we can alter our spiritual vision and see some amazing things.
That's right. And, you know, with some of the latest discoveries in science, especially in terms of quantum physics and the understanding of the zero-point field, it's really now up to us to get our heads around this idea of us being, you know, bundles of vibrating energy held together by consciousness. And when we can learn how to tune those bundles of vibrating energy and our consciousnesses in ways where we can begin to unlock the secrets of our body and perhaps the universe as a result, then we will really be making some strides forward. And I think that's where we're all heading, don't you?
Oh, I agree. And I think as I'm listening to you, not critiquing you, but the operative word in your question is the word, if we can get our heads around these ideas.
Yes.
And that's one of the primary metaphors. I mean, human civilization heretofore has been structured in a pyramidal structure where you have the vast majority of people as the base of the pyramid, and it angles itself upward until at the apex there are the chosen ones. But I think that what's happening is that image, that structure, is replaced by a circle or a ring. And what we're finding is that to the extent that we can close ourselves into the circle or put ourselves into the circle, that's what's going to create the unity. That's what's going to create the new ring or vibration of consciousness that's going to enable us to literally ring at a higher frequency as a civilization. We're never going to get there so long as we have the pyramidal structure. It's just not going to work.
That's right. Now, let's talk about the body, because this show is called Otherware. We explore the realms of being a multidimensional human, being a person that lives not only here in this third dimension, but has many other experiences and many other levels of awareness that can be accessed through this being here on the third dimension. And the other part of the show is to explore what the inner technologies are that we might have that exist on our multidimensional levels. And I know that that's a big part of your work, and that one of the most extraordinary theories that you've researched and written extensively about is that the human body is a resurrection tool, a ladder or stairway to heaven, just as we mentioned briefly then, we're talking about the eye. But I'd really love to go into that a little bit more deeply with you. I know that you understand the chakra system, and perhaps we could talk a little bit about that.
Sure, yeah. This whole idea of the human body as a resurrection machine came out of research that I was doing in the myths, the Egyptian myths of Isis and Osiris. And on my website and my books, I very frequently cite this example of Isis standing beside her companion, Osiris, who was the Egyptian god of resurrection. It was the Egyptian savior who many think could have been a prototype for the Jesus story. And when you see Isis standing beside Osiris, what you see it like, as for example at Abydos in Egypt, is that Osiris is not portrayed as a person or as a humanoid figure. Osiris is portrayed as what appears to be some kind of a device. And I use that word device intentionally because when you look up the word device in the dictionary, it can refer to an instrument, an appliance, some kind of a mechanical contraption, but it's also a symbol. And in fact, when you look at the Osiris device as it was portrayed in Egypt, it looks like it has as its platform, as its base, the biblical Ark of the Covenant. And attached to this platform that resembles the Ark of the Covenant is an antenna, or what appears to be an antenna, that has two tablets sitting on top of it. The Egyptian name for this antenna, or this pillar attachment, is called the Shuti pillar, which means enlightenment. And one day, just kind of in a flash of inspiration, I visualized a meditating person sitting with this device of Osiris running through their body. And it became clear to me at that moment that what Osiris was, what resurrection machine that the Egyptians were describing, the resurrection device called Osiris, is actually the human body. And when that happened for me, I'm still writing books about that concept. I could probably write another 30 books about that concept. I'm going back to Egypt in March to investigate it further. And it's, to me, absolutely valid and what I think the Egyptians were intending for us to take from that iconography and that the use of that symbol or that device. And as I continued to look at that, I had to ask the question, well, if the Egyptians were portraying the Ark of the Covenant as this platform for this pillar, why didn't the Israelites then show the Ark of the Covenant with this enlightenment pillar attached? And I have a couple of thoughts on that. One is that it's possible that they mentioned it. They do refer to Aaron's rod that budded, that was housed within the Ark of the Covenant, the box. Aaron is a word that means enlightenment, so it could, in fact, be a reference to this. And by the way, I do think that the Israelite Ark Covenant is a miniature version of the Egyptian original. But as I continued to think about this, I started to think in these terms, and that was that when we look at this story, we find that the Hebrew religion was a patriarchal or is a patriarchal religion, and it was implemented in order to supersede former or earlier religions that were often dominated by the feminine. And in fact, in the various depictions of this Osiris device and the variations that I feel appear in different cultures, it's always the women, the feminine, that are operating this device. As if to say they were the ones that possessed the secrets of this resurrection machine or the resurrection device. And so it began to become, or at least a supposition began to become clear as to why they removed that enlightenment pillar. And the reason was is that if the Ark of the Covenant is a reflection of our inner spiritual technology, then that means the Ark of the Covenant as the base or platform for the enlightenment pillar is represented by the first three chakras.
Yes.
And the idea then would be that if you're a patriarchal religion and intent on installing a patriarchal version of the story that, by my definition, is one that is about controlling and manipulating people, you want people living in their first three chakras. You want them focused on only the questions of where am I going to eat? Where am I going to sleep? Who am I going to sleep with? And today, questions like, what's on cable tonight? Because the idea is that once an individual learns that they have this enlightenment pillar already within their being, the stairway to heaven attached, their life's questions tend to change. They begin to think about such questions as, where did I come from? How did I get here? What am I doing here? And more importantly, how do I leave? And those are the questions they, quote unquote, they don't want us asking, because when you begin to ask those questions, you're out of control. You're beyond manipulation. You're beyond control. You don't have a need for a priest. You don't have a need for a pope. You don't have a need for a pimp or a politician. You don't need any of those people any longer. So that's kind of the reason why I think that many of these secrets have been withheld, and why especially so many of the established religions are outer directed. They don't want you looking inside. They want you looking outside for direction and looking to others other than yourself for guidance and for direction in your life.
Well, you know, that's a real Piscean energy as well. The whole last 2,000 years that Christ's birth inaugurated of the Piscean Age were pretty much directed by ideas of devotion, idealism, looking outside of yourself for the answers. And of course, as we're moving in, and now I think, are we fully into the age of Aquarius, or are we not quite there?
It's controversial. I would say we're definitely, many people are in the mindset of the Aquarian age, whether or not we're actually there or not.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that as well. And you see it everywhere. People are starting to look inside for the answers now. They're starting to trust their own truths and not rely so much on what someone else is going to tell them. And that will become more and more prevalent, I'd say, as time goes along. You mentioned the word they, quote unquote. Let's talk a little bit about who this group is and how your research might tie into them. Does that word they relate to the illumined ones of antiquity, including the Sumerians, the Egyptians, and the alchemists? Have they got anything to do with this group who are in the now? Kind of like the world management team, as I like to call them.
Yeah, the world management team. That's a good one.
Yeah.
I tend to rely on the work of Zachariah Sitchin in this regard. I really enjoy and continue to investigate his take that the original gods who came to Earth were divided into two factions, that you had one group of gods that essentially viewed the human race as slaves and sex objects. Then you had another group of the world management team, to use your term, that sought to elevate humankind to the level of the gods with little g's, and even to exceed the capabilities of the gods. And throughout time, there's been a conflict between these two energies or these two literal factions. And here in America, we see that reflected in our politics. You tend to have the one wing of the party seeks to increase the military budget at the same time that it decreases the educational budget. In other words, up with the military, down with education. While the other wing of the party tends to have a platform that says, well, let's increase the education budget and slash the military budget. So up with education, down with the military. And it's remarkable how this story seems to be the guiding myth of all of human civilization.
Well, maybe this guiding myth was a necessary construct for the last 26,000 years of being immersed in 3D and polarity, because it's all about polarity, isn't it? But as we close the cycle, you know, I feel that the old world energy is crumbling and things like these guiding myths are crumbling along with it. As we look around and see the emergence of a new paradigm, I really hope that, you know, we humans will be able to lift our hearts and minds up to create a template that maybe helps us awaken to multidimensional selves and also supports us being able to operate from a place of unity consciousness, prosperity consciousness, and unconditional love. We're speaking with William Henry, the remarkable investigative mythologist and expert on the ancient stargates of the gods.
Downloading otherware.
How come so many examples of ancient myths and scripture time and time again revolve around beings that travel to the stars through gates or doors? And why is it that you find these depictions and stories through cultures that have spanned, you know, literally thousands of years, from the Sumerians to the Mayans? You see this concept again and again.
Yeah, and it's one of my favorite hobbies is to collect those very depictions. I probably have, in my opinion, the largest private collection of them. I'm sure there's universities that might have larger collections. Nobody that I'm aware of other than myself really has dedicated as much time and effort to seeing these images of these gods coming and going through these gates. And it's to me that when you look at the evidence that's left, and again, it's not proof that they travel through gates, but it's evidence and pictures and consistency of these images that suggest that this is how people perceive the gods coming and going to Earth, was through these gates. So the idea would be that they are either literal physical gates that are some form of a technology that was brought here. Perhaps it was even sent here in advance of the arrival of the gods, like in the example of the Anunnaki. Or what we're talking about in these various depictions is that there's some sort of a a holographic projection almost, in which these gods appear, and it looks as if they're appearing in gates, but really it's almost as if they're in an airlock of some kind, or in some kind of an intermediate phase in between the material world and the immaterial world. And for a brief moment, like Moses's encounter with Yahweh in the burning bush, they appear in this zone of frequency or vibration, but they're not literal or material beings. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So I'm not quite sure which it is, that it's that they are actual literal gates like you saw in the movie Stargate, for example, where it's a material technology, or if in fact we are talking about perhaps even a mental experience that people tap into, and their recollection of that experience, like having a dream, is that in this experience these gods were coming through a portal of some kind. Personally, I think that they are material. I think they're real. I think there's actual technology that can be employed to open these gateways.
Do you think that that technology is still here somewhere on Earth, waiting to be found?
I do. And, you know, of course, the primary story that I point to, the primary drama that I believe involves the search for these gateways, is the run-up to the war in Iraq, and in fact, the war in Iraq itself.
Well, that's a huge subject, but I would love to delve into it a little bit with you because, you know, one of the first things that happened when the troops landed in Iraq was the Baghdad Museum was looted.
Right.
What was that about?
Well, in my opinion, it was a Delta Force search and destroy mission to collect images and ancient evidence of a vastly advanced technology that centered around the creation of these gateways, but one of the spin-offs was the ability to create weapons of mass destruction from this same technology.
Do you think that there may also be some kind of portal opening in that region around on the Earth that perhaps enabled the gods with little g's to come here in the first place with that technology?
Right. I mean, we have to remember we're in Iraq, which is called ancient Sumer or Mesopotamia. It's there that we found one of the premier gateway stories, the Tower of Babel episode. And in this story, which took place between, say, 1800 and 2000 BC, Nimrod had gathered humankind together in order to build a ladder or gate to God. But Yahweh, the Old Testament God, decided that he didn't want company at that time, so he smashed our tower and separated humankind by language, something that is still in effect today. Not only was that gate smashed, but then Yahweh went one step forward to cover up this whole story by having the Hebrew scribes, or influencing the Hebrew scribes, to change the meaning of the word Babel from gate or ladder to God to its new meaning, which was confusion and nonsense. And this is where we get our modern English word, a babbler. If someone's speaking nonsense or they're confused or incoherent, they are a babbler. And what that means is it ultimately refers to this Tower of Babel episode. And it suggests to me that, hey, you know, they want you to think that anybody that talks about the possibility of this gate being literal or real is in fact confused and incoherent.
And why is that? Why do they want people to be confused and incoherent?
The lens through which I'm looking at that question right now is the early Christian lens.
Right.
And the first Christians had a group of books that was preserved in the Nag Hammadi Library, which was discovered in 1945. And in that library is a book called The Hypostasis of the Archons. Well, it's also called The Reality of the Rulers. And it describes these inorganic beings that sound very strikingly similar to what modern extraterrestrial researchers call greys or beings such as that. These archons created a prison of perception, a prison of consciousness. It was the belief of these first Christians that this world that we live in was created by these diabolical archons to imprison us in order for them to harvest energy from us. They use us, they view us sort of like in the movie The Matrix, as batteries capable of discharging this fear. The only way to escape this total mind control program, which is what it is to find the gate. And that's the last thing they want. And so what they do is talk about those that speak of it as babblers or incoherent people. And they tell us that the physics involved in creating these gates is vastly beyond our reach. In fact, we'll never, ever be able to do such things.
It is a mind control program that we're all living in right now and that we're all trying to, well, that some of us at least, trying to break away from and help show others that that exists. I'd like to go back to Baghdad and to some of the stuff that's going on there at the moment before we move on into that, because that's a whole other bag of worms.
No pun intended.
No pun intended.
Right.
Could we talk a little bit more about how the Stargate technology that may exist in modern-day Iraq and that perhaps Saddam Hussein even knew about could be being turned into weapons?
Sure. And in order to, I think it'd be worth spending just a quick minute to run through the story of Saddam and
sure.
his Stargate connection. I'm actually the person that brought this story forward, and the entire premise is based upon Saddam Hussein's publicly proclaimed belief that he is, feels like he is, in fact, the reincarnation of the biblical king Nebuchadnezzar. He had spent the 1980s rebuilding Babylon in order to match and even outdo the accomplishments of Nebuchadnezzar, and in every way, shape, and form, wanted the Iraqi people to connect himself to Nebuchadnezzar. Well, when you go back into the book of Daniel, you find one of the most amazing gateway stories you're ever going to read. In the story, Nebuchadnezzar had constructed this massive golden image of the beast, as it was called. The thing appears to stand around 90 feet tall. It's a giant piece of hardware, is the description that the book of Daniel gives of this thing. The problem was that Nebuchadnezzar had the hardware, but he didn't apparently have the software in order to make the thing work. But he knew that the wise men from the Temple of Solomon in Jerusalem did possess that software. So, long about, 680 BC, somewhere in there, he invades, 600 BC, he invades Jerusalem, ransacks the temple, brings the Jews back to Babylon in the famed Babylonian captivity, and among them are several prophets, including Ezekiel, including Daniel, and including three wise men from the Temple of Solomon. Nebuchadnezzar was most intimately interested in the three wise men, and in fact, as the book of Daniel tells us, he made them a wager that if they could open the fiery furnace that worked in conjunction with this golden image of the beast, that he would convert to their religion. So in the story, the three wise men, whose name are Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, put on their coat, their hat, and their other garments, which are very interesting, and they enter this fiery furnace. Nebuchadnezzar and his assembled gather around the fiery furnace. They expect the three wise men to come back out as toasted marshmallows. As a matter of fact, they don't come back as toasted marshmallows, and when they return, not only are they in pristine condition, they're not alone. The book of Daniel tells us that one like, or actually the Son of God, is now accompanying them. And so the question is, what just happened in that episode? Did these three wise men put on some kind of clothing or other accoutrements and enter a gateway, a fiery furnace, a stargate of vibration, go travel to some place and come back with Jesus in tow? I mean, that's what we are asked to consider happened in that episode.
And what do you think happened?
I think they brought the Son of God back. And in fact, what makes it interesting is that the book of Daniel drops the story cold. I mean, if you're just think, you know, all of a sudden you've got one like, or actually the Son of God who has just come to earth, you would think that they would be all over this guy, wanting to know, well, you know, what secret knowledge might he possess? What wisdom might he possess? But the book of Daniel says absolutely nothing about anything like that. But in the Iraqi tradition, we learn a lot about this guy. His name was Nabu. This is where Nebuchadnezzar, in fact, got his name.
Mm.
And the name Nabu means the Lord. And as it turns out, they built whole ziggurats and vast temples, libraries for Nabu. And they filled it up with the knowledge that this figure had to offer. Saddam Hussein knew about this stuff. He was collecting these very tablets and this ancient knowledge. Among the knowledge that's delivered, in my opinion, when you trace this story, it ultimately comes down to the alchemical knowledge, how to manipulate the elements, how to manipulate matter. It may even have represented a very advanced physics.
Well, there's a mythology around Saddam Hussein that apparently he wore something around his neck that allowed him to become invisible sometimes. I don't know how much truth to that, but just the fact that the mythology around him exists means
precisely
that, you know, there must be some truth to it, or he must have had some esoteric knowledge.
Right, or somebody is running some kind of a psychological operation, a psyop here, some kind of, again, mind control type of thing, because they want you to believe that he is this biblical figure. And other commentators pick this up and say, well, yeah, it's because the people running the show are rapture crazy. They believe in the end of the world idea. And the only way that the Lord can return is if they rebuild Babylon and destroy it, because that's the trigger for the return of the Lord.
So you think that that's what this is all about, destroying Babylon so that the Armageddon can occur and the second coming can then eventuate?
Yeah, I think that I don't personally believe in the second coming as it's brought forward in this scenario, but I think that they are operating on that script, yes.
Yeah, it's a very interesting perspective, but it seems, you know, when you say it like that, it seems so obvious that they're hell-bent on Armageddon and creating you know, an end-time scenario that is cataclysmic.
Precisely.
But,
and it doesn't have to be that way.
Well, no, and I think that that's why people like you are working and spreading this knowledge, disseminating it around the world through your books, your DVDs, and interviews like this, so that more and more people can begin to take another look at what they're being given and reassess for themselves whether they want to buy into that picture or not, and hopefully not.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this whole war on terror business is really, and it's just nothing more than a giant, they're just terrorizing the whole planet. And I think the reason is because they know that the tremendous forces of change are, of a positive change, are washing over the planet. And we can't have that now. You know, we can't have peace on earth and goodwill towards men, because then we don't have military budgets. Then we don't have the control that we have right now. So, I mean, I was just, my heart, it didn't break. I just was in shock almost when I had been writing a book called Ark of the Christos, in which I was researching this whole age in the run-up to 2012 and in the Maya understanding of the galactic center, and especially their understanding that this was not only, it was a place of immense beauty, the galactic center. It's the place where they tell us our souls came from. It's also a star nursery, but it's also a place of tremendous destruction. Stars are literally annihilated at this place. If they go into the black hole at the galactic center, so that center is both it's a two-edged sword. It's a place of terror, and it's a place of terror, of great compassion and enlightenment and great, tremendous, powerful forces, terrible forces. And the Mayans are telling us that run up to 2012 here, we've got this rare alignment with the galactic center that will introduce an age, in fact, of terror, of compassion, of enlightenment, of cosmogenesis. But no, they had to take terror and twist it into terror. And what they've done is effectively created this giant pillar on our planet. Might as well be in the North Pole. And the word written on that pillar is terror. And what they're attempting to do is to tie the consciousness of every human being on this planet to that pillar. To, you know, sort of like chaining your dog to a pillar when you go into a store. They want us parked on that vibration of terror, of free. And we have to stop that.
Well, we do have to stop that, and I'd love to ask you how you're doing that in your own life personally. you know, with all of the research that you do into the body as a resurrection tool, into the way our chakra system can be tuned to basically end with the result of our pineal gland being fully activated and releasing what you refer to as an oil, metaphorically, that will then allow expanded and altered states of consciousness that will give us that stairway to heaven that you talk so much about. What do you do in your life to enhance your own body's abilities to reach that stairway to heaven?
Well, I do things I enjoy, for one. Moment to moment, trying to focus on not just joy, but things that I enjoy doing. I mean, it's action from a day-to-day, on a day-to-day basis. The analogy that I use is to keep your vibration high. If you think of a crystal bowl, in order to get a crystal bowl ringing or singing, you take a mallet or a baton and you gently tap it, and then you start gently working the baton around the rim of the crystal bowl, and before you know it, you've got this amazingly powerful vibration coming from this bowl. Well, if I view myself as a crystal bowl, then that means I have to constantly be stimulating that frequency or vibration, like just like the mallet going around the bowl. So I look for things that I can do that will bring that kind of joy. And to me, fortunately, it's things that are right in front of me. It's playing guitar, it's walking, it's drinking water. It's all of those things that constantly reinforce that vibration.
Have you done anything like meditation techniques or any work on that level on your subtle bodies?
Some, yeah. Not as much as I would like, but I do, yeah. I reference a prayer posture in a couple of my books with the outstretched arms that I feel puts us in a sort of an antenna-like position, a prayer posture that will enable those energies to come through. So I work with that, and that's really it.
You know, the Mayans, as you said earlier, believe that the time that we're leading up to now, towards 2012 and beyond, is a time of a golden age, symbolized, of course, by 1,000 years of peace. And the bringing back together or the balancing once again of the male and female, what do you think about that?
Well, personally, I think it's the whole basis for awakening a person or bringing about the internal balance or harmony. I do tarot readings. I've done tarot readings professionally for, I don't know, 6 years now. I read Clive Barrett's Ancient Egyptian Tarot. And the reason I read that deck is because he clearly, clearly portrays the inner male and female duality. And in so providing that kind of a mirror, he presented an amazing tool just to kind of check in and see how are my inner male and female looking. And what I believe is that, first of all, recognizing that you have that inner male and female duality is about 9/10 of the awakening right there.
Yeah.
I mean, most people don't even have a clue about that, you know?
Yeah.
But then others that do, because once you have that awakening, now that changes all of your relationships. It changes your relationship with yourself. It changes your relationship with everybody that you encounter. And it puts you on that path then to harmonizing those two sides, and in so doing, creating that third harmonic that is really the portal or the gateway that we've been talking about.
That's right. That's right. We're having a wonderful discussion with internationally known author of 12 books, lecturer and investigative mythologist William Henry. I'm Liz Miller, and you're tuned in to Otherwhere, and I hope you're enjoying the show. We'll be back in a few minutes to conclude our interview with William, and when we do, I'll be asking him about supergalactic waves, Project Stardust, whether Mary Magdalene was an alchemist, and what his vision for the future is. All that after this.
Yeah.
Dr. Paul Violet believes that every now and then solar systems, or galaxies actually, go through a period called supernova, where an explosion occurs in the center of the galaxy, and particles are then released throughout the galaxy carrying particular properties, and that Earth has in the past been the recipient of some of these particles that intermittently spewed out from the center of our galaxy. What do you think about that?
Oh, I'm tremendously interested in it. I put I give it a lot of credence and credibility. Dr. LaViolette says that such an event is imminent, which means it could happen anytime in the next 400 years or so. He thinks it's overdue. And I've kind of picked up on that whole concept. The images of the galactic center going starburst, as it's also called, and spewing out this tremendous energy, these images are stunningly gorgeous. I mean, you just have never seen anything just it's so amazing looking, so terrifying, and at the same time, so just stunningly beautiful.
I have seen a couple of them myself. They are gorgeous.
Yeah, it's really something, and we've been able to observe it in other galaxies. And so the strange thing about this is that as I started following the trail of this image, and once you see this image of the matter spewing out of the galactic center from both the top and the bottom, you readily recognize that when you see it again. And I've actually found examples of it on vases from ancient Crete, and I've also found examples of it in the symbol system of the Cathars of southern France, who claimed that they were taught a secret symbol system by Jesus or his disciples.
Wow.
And what it suggested to me in each of the examples where I found it is that it raised a question. Is it possible that these ancient people had an ability to, I use the word harvest, these high-energy cosmic rays and these special particles coming from these events? And were they able to put those energies to high spiritual use? And I think that they did.
Well, if you think something came from the center of our galaxy, it must have some spiritual use to it.
Well, sure.
You know, if that's the womb of our, that's where our souls originate from, if that's the place where all life originates in this whole galaxy, then of course.
Yeah, you probably heard back just a couple weeks ago about NASA's Project Stardust.
Oh, I can't wait to talk to you about that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they believe that the cosmic dust particles, the interstellar dust particles that Stardust collected came from the direction of the galactic center.
Really? So that there could have actually been an explosion already?
Well, somebody, another researcher named Jay Widener, who is very interested and knows Paul LaViolette very well, and is a deep investigator of LaViolette's theory in that, he suggested to me or told me that he thought that one of the Project Stardust's hidden agendas was to count the number of dust particles and increase in the number of dust particles coming from the direction of the galactic center as an early warning detection system for the possibility that a galactic superwave was, in fact, about to pile drive the planet.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So if this wind is coming, as LaViolette has theorized, well, we're going to see a front wave of these dust particles coming. You're talking about an explosion in the galactic center. And so these dust particles then would be the outer rim or the first particles that came out of this explosion. When I interviewed Dr. Don Brownlee, NASA's lead investigator on Stardust for Dreamland, and I asked him about that, and he said no, that was not one of its purposes. He was familiar with LaViolette's theory, but he said that one of Stardust's purposes was not to prove or disprove that part of LaViolette's theory.
So then really it's about proving that trying to find out then how our solar system might have evolved from those
not only our
particles?
Solar system, but also our bodies, because we are made of this stuff.
Yeah, we are made of stardust. I love that. Would you explain to the listeners exactly what that means?
Well, what it means is that long ago, when the forces of creation were starting to move through our galaxy, that this primordial matter that may even be a magical substance, sort of like Disney's pixie dust, was ejected from the galactic center, and massive quantities of this stuff piled up here on our planet and eventually formed the body.
And so as we are now on the verge of unlocking some of those secrets of some of those tiny primeval particles, we're really on the verge of kind of unlocking a whole new Akashic record, aren't we?
Well, the scientists involved in Project Stardust literally said each particle was a whole library into itself.
Wow.
And I, too, like you, made the leap to Galactic Hall of Records.
Yeah.
Here it is.
Yeah.
You know, I call it the anointing of the dove, where the dove is an allegory or metaphor for the Milky Way galaxy, which looks like a giant bird hovering in space, with its galactic center being its body and the wings of the galaxy literally being the wings of the dove. Well, to me, here was the galaxy saying, here's some pristine cosmic particles. Let's see what you do with these things. You know, and I asked Brownlee about that, too, and he said, well, yeah, because I said, this is mythic. This is epic. It may even be prophetic what you guys are doing, because the Book of Revelation talks about a new white stone, or a white stone upon which is written a new name of the Lord. So I'm looking at these pristine, pure cosmic particles saying, could these be the white stone? And when I asked Don Brownlee about that, again, NASA's lead investigator on Starburst, or Stardust, he said, well, he hadn't really thought about it in those mythic terms, but he said that what is really significant to the Stardust team was that we had to go get this stuff. It wasn't going to come to us. We had to achieve a certain level of technological proficiency in order to reach out and get these dust particles. And to him, he said that was very significant. And just as an interesting turn of events, when the Stardust capsule was landing, Brownlee describes how the scientists ran out of their trailer and were screaming at the top of their lungs with joy. And he looked up and he said the spacecraft looked like a magic wand.
Wow.
In the sky. And here comes this Stardust out of it. And so, you know, it was great because I talked with him about 3-4 weeks ago. It was, you know, a couple of weeks before the Stardust returned. And it was just really interesting to get his take on it then, and then to read his responses afterward. He sounded like a magician. These guys are magicians.
Well, you know, they are. It might not be exactly the same sort of magic that we think of when we think of magicians, but they definitely are. And
right.
I can't wait to see what they do with it, which leads me to the idea of white stone, the white powder gold, the manna. Mm-hmm. These are all themes throughout your work that seem to now be coming together in this Project Stardust.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and I'm going to be continuing to follow up on it and try to get as many inside details as possible. Certainly be keeping in touch with Dr. Brownlee, but I'm also going to be getting in touch with Florida State. They're going to be doing some of the testing down there with a particle accelerator. And they're telling us that late March is when we can expect to hear the earliest results about Stardust. So it's going to start coming quickly.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how the particles or the white stones that may have been picked up through Project Stardust do relate to the manna from heaven that we hear described in the Bible, or in modern-day terms, the white powder gold or monatomic elements that have now recently come back into use.
Right. And, you know, I've corresponded with Lawrence Gardner about this project. In fact, he's the author of Bloodline of the Holy Grail and Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark and other books. And I first started hearing about Stardust from him a few years ago, where he was making the direct connection between Stardust as the interstellar dust and throughout our Milky Way, and these monoatomic elements. And he, in fact, told me that there are Stardust analysis reports dating back a good many years, and they are unanimous in classifying this Stardust as a unique form of silica. And that is what Lawrence says is much as the same case with the monoatomic transition group elements. And so chances are that the new tests from Project Stardust will reveal the same results as the older Stardust results. And if so, then, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see how this all plays out.
It certainly will. Now, one of the latest releases that you've put out on DVD is called Anointing the Dove, and it's a fascinating exploration into whether Mary Magdalene could have possibly been someone with alchemical knowledge who might have been initiated into ancient mysteries such as the mysteries of the Temple of Hathor in Egypt. And it's just such a huge subject, but I really want to ask you who Mary Magdalene was, in your opinion.
Okay. In a nutshell, the picture of the story that I would tell about Mary Magdalene, and this is kind of a off the top of my head assemblage of all the various sources that I've accumulated, I would say that she was probably from Syria. She was trained in the mystery schools of ancient Egypt, including those of Isis and Hathor. She would have been trained in the mystery schools of the ancient Anunnaki in Syria, following in the path of Inanna. And what she was trained to do was to formulate alchemical substances, including an anointing oil. And what we find is there was one night in a place called Capernaum, which is where Jesus and Mary Magdalene first met, where the Bible asks us to believe that this was a random event, a pure coincidence that these two would have happened to have run into one another. But the research I've turned up says, hey, wait a minute, you know, she was his equal in every way, shape, and form. In fact, she might, her knowledge might even have been more advanced than his. And he could not perform his mission without her assistance. And in fact, another person that Mary Magdalene is very reminiscent of, in fact, very resonant with, is Nefertiti, who is the bride of Akhenaten.
Yes.
And she also was a perfumer, like Mary Magdalene. She, too, was the bride and wife of and the sacred partner of a messiah. And it's interesting that Akhenaten and Nefertiti's depictions in ancient Egypt are among the only examples where you see a family in an intimate scene. And, in fact, what we see in this intimate scene is that they're performing ceremony. They're receiving the celestial rays of a disc called the Aton. And what happened is Nefertiti is thought to have died before Akhenaten. And in fact, after her death, you never ever again see Akhenaten performing ceremony. The explanation that scholars give for this is that he had a broken heart, and therefore he didn't want to perform any more of these religious ceremonies. My take is he couldn't perform those ceremonies because Nefertiti was no longer there. She was the one that possessed the initiatory knowledge and the knowledge of how to make the ceremony work. I think that Mary Magdalene and Jesus had a similar relationship, that Mary Magdalene brought a tremendous amount of knowledge to the table. Take her out of the picture. There is no Jesus as we think of him. And there's a lot of funny business in that story, and in my book, The Illuminator, I focus on that episode in Capernaum, and this, because just before Jesus meets Mary Magdalene, he has to have a shootout with the rabbis at the temple, and they demand that he produce the manna, because that's what Moses had done. And if Jesus is in any way, shape, or form going to fulfill the shoes of the Messiah, well, he better well be able to produce the bread from heaven.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this bread is the key story. Well, then, lo and behold, Mary Magdalene shows up in his life that night. And we have this anointing that goes on there, But then later, Mary Magdalene is also present at the tomb on Easter morning. She is the first to see the risen Christ. Well, going back to Capernaum just for a second, Jesus made it very clear that Christ, bread, manna, this substance from heaven, are all the same thing. And so there's a pun there that I think is very important. What exactly did Mary Magdalene see when she saw the risen Christ, bread, manna, heavenly substance on Easter morning? What are we talking about here? What we're talking about is that she must have been some kind of an alchemist, and that Easter morning scene was some kind of an alchemical operation.
And the crucifixion, I know you have a totally different take on that, compared to Christian and religious points of view. What do you think actually happened in the crucifixion itself?
Well, you have two competing versions of what happened there. You have the traditional Christian view that Jesus and two unidentified thieves were crucified. And they were crucified at the hands of the Romans. Then in the parallel Gnostic Christian tradition, they put a real kink in this story. What happens is, going back into the book of Numbers, you have this very strange story of two spies named Joshua and Caleb who went to a place called Eshcol and stole this oversized cluster of grapes from the Anunnaki who lived at Eshcol. And there's some very interesting gateway connotations within that story, because Joshua reported to Moses that he saw people walking along the surface of the earth and they suddenly vanished. And the story that I interpret that is that they saw these people walk through a gateway. And this cluster of grapes, this oversized and possibly otherworldly cluster of grapes, in my opinion, symbolizes that vanishing point, that Anunnaki stronghold. Well, what happens is that in the Gnostic Christian parallel version of the crucifixion, the two thieves are portrayed carrying the cluster of grapes. The two thieves are Joshua and Caleb. But where they bring the cluster of grapes to is the crucifixion. And Joshua and Caleb are the two thieves crucified alongside of Jesus. Now, what that means to me is that the crucifixion was some kind of a gateway event. It's clearly connected to whatever happened in Numbers 13 when Joshua and Caleb stole that substance from the Anunnaki, and the Gnostic Christians want you to know that that substance, whatever that was present at the crucifixion.
So it was a Stargate event.
That's my interpretation. I started writing about this in my book, Blue Apples, and have continued on this line of research ever since then. I just can't get away from that interpretation of it. And again, it's based upon, I've got several different images of Joshua and Caleb stealing the cluster of grapes, and then this one in particular that comes from the cathedral at Sion, Switzerland, that portrays them bringing the cluster of grapes to the crucifixion. It clearly links the crucifixion with that event in Numbers 13. And that event in Numbers 13 looks like a gateway event. I'm saying the crucifixion was an event in which a door or a gate was opened, because this is how all the gods came and went. That's how they were transmitted or translated to the heavenly realms.
So then after Jesus' return, would you go back then and explain what the role of Mary Magdalene was upon his return?
Upon his return from the Stargate event?
Yeah.
Well, what we're left with is the story that she moved to southern France,
mm-hmm.
and that he later joined her, and that they deposited sacred knowledge in a tiny village called Rennes-le-Château.
And was that deposit a little child? Is that the Holy Grail?
Well, yeah. I mean, you have different takes on that. You have, some say they had an heir and a spare and a daughter.
Yes.
Some say they just had a daughter. I'm not as much interested in the bloodline idea. See, what I think happens is that in order to enter these gateways, there has to be there's a transformation that's undergone preparatory to that experience. There's a purification that must be undergone. Jesus even refers to that in the Pista Sophia when he responds to one of Mary Magdalene's questions by saying, don't do anything except find the cleansing mysteries that will transform you into a being of pure light so that you can inherit the light of my kingdom. That's the whole mission statement right there. That's the purpose of Earth Life, is finding the cleansing mysteries that will transform us into a being of pure light so that we can inherit the light of his kingdom. And, oh, by the way, you'll be able to finally escape the prison of perception set up by the archons. And, in fact, in the Gospel of Mary, which is another book written at the same time as the Pista Sophia, that's exactly the knowledge that Mary Magdalene is claimed to have received from the risen Jesus. Knowledge of how to get past the archons, knowledge of the workings of the heavens, and knowledge of how to get to the heaven.
Well, there are many, many speculations from many different researchers and sources of material out there that talk about the evolution of the human from Homo sapien into Homo luminis, or the light being, the human that is simply light. Do you think we're heading that way?
I think that type of a transformation, which is sort of like the cocoon turning into a butterfly, I think it happens intermittently throughout the ages, and I don't think it's a permanent transformation. I think it's a sort of graduation ceremony where a few are able to do this and the rest, they get plowed under.
So the few, would you call those people like the Ascended Masters?
Yeah.
Well, perhaps there'll be a time when there'll be that kind of transformation on a scale, of a mass scale, where everyone gets to that place at some point. I believe that we're all heading that way. How long it'll take, I have no idea.
Right.
But
I definitely
the goal, think that's where we're going.
Yeah, it's astonishing. I mean, you know, there's a scenario that I play out in my mind. It goes, you know, it's essentially that I have gold quantum dots that patrol my blood and cook six cells on the spot. I have a suit of armor, a skin of armor that can change its color and texture with a thought. It makes me resistant to ballistic or chemical attack. It's a second intelligent skin. If I fall, it breaks my leg. It begins to fix it. I'm totally impervious to any enemy's weapon. I'm connected to a global brain. And this suit that I'm wearing is going to ensure that I live for the next 300, 400 years so that I can effect this transformation into a being of light. I mean, I think that's what we're creating right now. Certainly the U.S. military is involved in that. And it's also going to become, I think, attractive on the commercial market for the average person. In the next 10 years or so, will start putting, making these augmentations to themselves. And what it's all going to be geared toward is prolonging our longevity. So you can prolong your longevity. That gives you a chance to accumulate more knowledge. And that's what's going to give you the chance to, especially to find the spiritual knowledge through which you can, to live forever, literally.
Well, that's a really interesting take on it, William. I actually am surprised to hear you say that you think that the evolution of humans will... I'm not really surprised to hear you say that there'll be some augmenting going on. I mean, people have been playing around with plastic surgery now and that kind of augmentation for a while to kind of get used to the idea of changing what their bodies look like and what they do. And, you know, with the advent of MP3 players and iPods and all that sort of stuff, really conditioning people into accepting machinery as part of their skin, literally.
Right. Now we're wearing our computers, so where they want to go with it is under the skin.
And we're driving in computers. Our cars literally are, you know, big computer banks. And we're surrounding ourselves with these very interesting frequencies all the time. And I think that being surrounded by all of these electromagnetic frequencies is not very enhancing to those inner technologies. You know, it's like putting all of the emphasis on what's going on the outside and, you know, making little attempts to put it inside by miniaturizing it is fine, but still it's technology and it's artificial, and eventually it will break down. So what we need to do, I believe, is find those inner technologies, develop those, because they're natural. They will never, ever break down. In fact, they'll only become enhanced the more we use them.
Right, yeah, and as I said a moment ago, this is a scenario that I play out in my mind because this is what is happening.
Mm.
And we have to ask, you know, is this immortality suit, as it's going to be sold to us, is it in fact a trap?
Oh, it's a total trap.
It's a total trap, of course. And then we have to look at, well, who is behind that trap? Who is manipulating us into this? And, you know, when I wear my iPod, am I buying into that? To that program that's ultimately going to lead to this massive trap. And you and I can see that that's where it's going, but everybody else, hey, you know, what are we going to do?
Well, I don't know if you've heard any of the stories about some of the more exclusive nightclubs in Europe who've been actually offering their members very cheap implants in order to get VIP entry to these clubs, as well as pay for their drinks at the bar. And the response has been quite enthusiastic. You know, it's actually happening. And people, unbelievably, aren't having to be coerced. I suppose it's, you know, you start with the pets and then you get comfortable with the idea of putting a chip inside your pet's body, and the next thing it's you.
Yeah, I know. And so you're right. I mean, it's pretty much going to be a war against the body.
Mm.
And again, I can't help but think it's because the body is so enormously powerful. I mean, it's here in America, especially. I mean, everything that goes in my mouth, essentially, that I buy at any kind of store is tightly regulated. Most everything that comes out of my mouth, in terms of what I can say on the radio or on the TV, is also tightly regulated.
Yeah.
And there's such tremendous control about this body, and it always begins when we're so young. I mean, one of the first things that we are taught about our body is that it's filthy. It stinks. You must control it. You must get this body under control. And then we never, ever learn what its capabilities are.
Well, you know, simple things like being taught how to breathe properly should be taught at kindergarten, and no one's even taught how to breathe properly, you know, from a young age. So where does that leave humankind?
Oh, I know.
Really basic things about how we work that are so important.
Well, in the next couple of months, I'm launching a new website. It's called Cosmic Kindergarten.
Really?
And what it's devoted to is, you know, everybody went to kindergarten, or most everybody did, but who went to Cosmic Kindergarten? And so it's not for kids necessarily, although it would be great for kids to visit it, but it's those types of things like you're describing that we should have been taught in kindergarten, but never were.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll have it, I hope to have it up by about the middle of April. I've got a number of years ago I was writing a children's book called Junior Cosmic Egg. it's the story of a cosmic egg named Junior who grows up to become his own universe.
Oh, that's great. So has that actually been released, or will it be released?
It will be. I'm going to put it up on the website, on the Cosmic Kindergarten site.
Yes.
And Junior will kind of be the main player, or the main guy in the thing. And that's where I'll start it. And I hope to just really expand the thing. I never taught kindergarten or anything, but at the point of the whole site and the story here is to, you know, on Sesame Street they teach us they teach children the meaning of the alphabet, but they never teach the sacred meaning of the alphabet.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be the aim of Cosmic Kindergarten, is to talk about the alphabet, talk about where did the letter A come from, and what does it mean from a sacred perspective.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful project, William, and I can't wait to see the results of it when it's finally up on the web.
Yeah, won't be long.
So will people be able to find that through williamhenry.net?
Yes.
Great.
Yeah, I'll have it linked up to my site.
And before we go, the last thing I wanted to talk to you about, which is probably one of the most exciting things for me, is the upcoming eclipse, and you're going to see it in Egypt.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, you must be so excited. Have you seen one before?
No, I have not. And certainly I've not seen one in Egypt, and it's the first time in a couple hundred years one's happened there, a total eclipse, and I can't wait.
It's almost like the gods have put this one together just for you.
Well, there's going to be a lot of people there. I mean, Egypt, a lot of people are making a mad dash to Egypt for this eclipse, so it should be really exciting.
Yeah, I was actually thinking of going over there myself. I went to see the last notable eclipse in 2002. And I can tell you now, William, that nothing and no one could possibly prepare you for what you're about to see. It's so incredibly transformative to stand on the earth, and I'm sure you'll be somewhere where you'll be in the center line of the actual path. If you can find that center line, please do it, because you can, you actually are part of a cosmic clock. You know, there's this beautiful synchronized universe all around you that you can see moving. And you're actually a part of that movement. And there's something about being in that direct line of the energy of the moon and the sun at the same time that is so incredibly balancing for the male and female polarities within us all. It's so joyful. It's so, so joyful. And I just can't wait to hear about what you think when you go.
Well, maybe I'll see you there. You never know, huh?
But no. So tell me, what are you doing? You're taking a group of people over there?
Yeah, we've got around 20 people. I'll be going with Freddie Silva, who's a crop circle researcher.
Oh, he is awesome.
Yeah, and really like the stuff he's doing. And so, it's going to be a really interesting time. In fact, but I think the focus of my research, I know I'm giving one talk called Isis Magdalene, which is more of the Isis Mary Magdalene connection, following up on that research. And then we'll see what else. I'm thinking focusing on more of the Egyptians' belief in eternity as well. That's something I'm very interested in right now, too.
And what have you got happening in terms of, you know, lectures where people might be able to see you in the next couple of months?
No conference. I'm doing individual lectures. I've got some exciting stuff coming up in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm doing a series of lectures in Atlanta. I live in Nashville, Tennessee, and Atlanta's just a few hours down the road. And so I've got those set up, and then it's Egypt. So everything right now is geared towards Egypt.
Well, I'm sure that you're going to have an incredible time, and I wish you the best of luck. Have a fabulous time away. And
thank you very much.
Thank you so much for spending the time with us today on BBS Radio with the Otherwhere audience. It's been such a pleasure.
Well, my pleasure too, Liz. I hope that we can do this again.
I'm sure we will. Well, take care, and we'll speak soon.
Visioning outside the box, then you need Otherwhere. Perhaps with a little bit more, we can all reinvent the box together. Well, we're at that time of the show when I sign off before we go into the relaxation. So make sure that the phone is off and that you won't be disturbed for the next 10 minutes or longer if you decide to stay there. Before I go, I want to let you know that next week on the show, I'll be chatting to a medical doctor that sees auras, Dr. Francesca McCartney, a medical intuitive and founder of the Institute for Intuition Medicine in California, will be joining us for an enlightening discussion on how you can hone your intuitive skills for better health. So make sure that you tune in next week. When Otherwhere returns, get ready to give something back to yourself and help defrag your body, mind, and spirit with progressive yoga relaxation. Get up. The practice of gratitude is life empowering. It can change the way you feel about yourself and life's events. With the attitude of gratitude, you can change the state of your consciousness. And studies are showing that the practice of gratitude is a powerful tool to get you through crises. It will improve your physical and emotional health, you experience less stress, and you'll be more relaxed and at peace. More nurturing relationships will come to you, and you'll feel uplifted and excited, thereby increasing the potential for good in your life. And the quality of your life is a result of what you focus on. The practice of focusing on all that you have amplifies and enriches the experience of everyday living. Like anything else, gratitude requires practice and discipline. There are many ways you can incorporate the practice of gratitude into your life, and you can begin with simple practices that develop gratitude. Remember, gratitude is a choice. It's a choice to see things differently. By focusing on the things you are grateful for, you give those aspects of your life more power, and your world begins to feel more full and alive. Here's what Joan Buckman says, a woman who suffered from fibromyalgia for 8 years before stabilizing through the use of keeping a gratitude journal. She says, gratitude is not about looking at the bright side or denying the realities of life. Gratitude goes much deeper than that. It's about learning from a situation, taking the good to help deal with other challenges in the future. It's about finding out that you have more power over your life than you previously imagined. You can stop being a victim of your circumstances and reach out to the joy in living. If you open your heart to the good in your life, gratitude becomes as much a part of your life as breathing. So, how do you get to a place of gratitude? Gratitude requires that you open your heart. So let's begin by relaxing our bodies, then linking up with the web of love and doing just that. So if you're lying down and comfortable, make sure that you're warm, that your spine is straight. Draw the chin in towards the chest and flatten out the back of the neck. Squeeze the shoulder blades together and open the chest. Feel the breath gently coming in and out of your body. And take slow, rhythmic breaths. Drawing your focus inward, away from the outside world. And take a long, deep breath in. and out again. Noticing how your body begins to slow down. And you draw your senses inward, leaving just enough awareness to hear my voice guide you into a place of deep peace, a place of deep gratitude. Now check your hands, make sure that the palms are turned up and they're resting by your sides. Allow the fingers to curl gently like a baby's. And then check that your feet are also loosely flopped to the sides and that you can feel your spine is straight and aligned. Now focus on the rising and falling of your chest. As you breathe in and out, feel your focus moving into your heart, a place where gratitude emanates from, and visualize the web. It's an energetic web which connects the divine essence of all beings on this planet. It literally surrounds and envelops our planet and all who live here. We are all interconnected by divine love. So as you listen to the sound of my voice, make the choice to become aware of this now. In your mind's eye, see the globe, dotted all around by the people who are listening to this show, forming the Otherwhere circle of lights, and all of the other people that are connected to the web, the hearts of all beings and their deepest essences, connecting to your heart now. And as you breathe, exchange your sacred love, breathing it in and out to everybody in the web. And keep your focus on the breath, slow, gentle, easy breaths. Continuing to breathe. Think about the things in your life that bring you happiness and joy, such as special people, your home, your garden, the sounds of nature like birds singing, whatever it is that warms your heart. Another way is to focus your attention on the sounds of the breeze, if you can hear it blowing through the trees outside, or just to become more aware of the ground beneath you. Allow yourself to soften and gently release every muscle in your body. By observing with conscious awareness, you move into gratitude. The mere act of conscious and intentional observation and appreciation is an expression of gratitude. So as you focus on these things, notice if you feel more peaceful, more calm, and allow these feelings to penetrate into every part of your body, into your emotions, your mind, and your spirit. Now you are in a state of gratitude. So continue to work with your visualizations. continue to be aware of the ground beneath you. And now, in the quietness, feel your whole body melting into a state of pure gratitude, releasing and giving in more and more. And in the quietness, feel your whole body moving deeper and deeper and deeper. Thank you. allow your awareness to come back into the present. But as you come back, feel your awareness slowly returning to the present and being aware of that wonderful feeling of love and gratitude that you've generated in your heart and every part of your body. Notice how your heart feels now. Be aware that something has changed. Feel yourself in this beautiful place of deep peace and gratitude. Observe your heart. How does it feel? Is it larger? Does it feel more open? Or does it feel so full that it is almost overflowing? So now, allow the fingers and toes to move once again. But allow that feeling of gratitude to remain in your body, in your mind, your emotions, and your spirit. Remember that gratitude acknowledges our receiving of abundance, and in and of itself becomes an act of giving back to the universe. Abundance then becomes a natural byproduct of gratitude. Remember that gratitude is becoming consciously aware of all that there is for us in life, and then acknowledging the gift. This aligns us with the universal principles that giving is the same as receiving. In graciously receiving the gifts that life provides us, we give back the gift of gratitude. Show and express your gratitude, and you will see that your life is a beautiful string of miracles.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.